1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. On Joe at RT.ie, from what we're hearing, the anti-vaxxers are out in force. Well, they're on the phone and in force, or on their laptops in force, and they're making dummy bookings in as many places as they can find that that are opening indoors. And then, of course, they're not turning up. Paula, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe.
You got a call yesterday from who?
Well, I was going about my business. My phone rang. I got a very nice lady on the phone, and she was phoning to confirm my booking for yesterday evening in their restaurant.
Okay.
So she said, "Are you Paula?" She gave me all of my details, including my phone number and my email address, and she said, "I'm phoning to confirm your booking. Your reservation is here in front of me for tonight." And I said, "I did not make a reservation.
Mm-hmm.
I have not made a reservation. You know, why are you phoning me? How did you get my details?" So we then went on to have a chat, and she was very apologetic. And she said that she had over 30 of these bookings. And to their mind, it seemed to be evolving that it was a strategy, if you like, of the anti-vaxxers to make dummy bookings in the names of people that they had obtained their details from goodness knows where.
And what was the name of this gastro pub or establishment?
It's very well known, Daphne and Nesbitt.
Oh, yes. Oh, world famous. Have you ever been in Daphne and Nesbitt?
I have, yes, on plenty of occasions. I haven't obviously been recently.
Okay. Have you ever had occasion to give your details to Daphne and Nesbitt?
No, because none of this was an issue before COVID, so obviously they wouldn't have had any of my details, and that made it even more surprising.
But whoever made a booking in Daphne and Nesbitt had your name, your address, your email, your phone number?
Yeah, all spelled correctly, all accurate.
Have you ever, have you sold anything recently on a public forum, Done Deal, Daft, any of those?
No. Wow. I don't know where they got the details from, Joe, but the fact that they had them, and they had used them to impersonate me to make what turned out to be a false booking, to my mind, and it's one of the reasons that I rang, it's despicable. It's a malicious tactic to undermine the restaurant trade that are, to my mind, bending over backwards to not only open and spend money, but...
And it's it's identity theft.
Absolutely, and I mean, that rings every alarm bell in my head, especially on the heels of the HSE.
From what we're hearing on the phone lines, and indeed anecdotally this morning on Liveline, is that since indoor dining has opened yesterday, effectively, a lot of staff are getting a lot of hassle at the doors from anti-vaxxers, and you know the phrase that was used, apartheid, and awful phrases were used in the Dáil last week by Matty McGrath, which weren't censured, which should have been censured, making reference to a situation in Germany, the Nazi Holocaust. Despicable. But apparently the staff are getting a lot of hassle. Let me say with us, Paula, and thanks for alerting us to this, because it seems to be a campaign. John O'Brien is manager of Daphne and Nesbitt's at Baga Street in Dublin. John, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe? Good afternoon.
Are you aware of this?
Oh, I am indeed, yeah.
So what's happening?
Well, yesterday, Helen, or the girl who looked after the bookings, went down to the office to look after the bookings, and she went through the emails. She sent all the emails back, and they all bounced. So then she rang the numbers, and people didn't make a booking at all.
Wow. And did the numbers invariably coincide with the names that had been given?
No.
Okay, they were just random numbers.
They sent me a state agent number and doctor's number.
Publicly available numbers,
so to speak.
Okay, and where do you think they're getting the information? Are they using Done Deal? You know, when someone puts up an ad in Done Deal, they might put in their name and email, and sometimes their mobile.
Yeah, obviously so. I wouldn't be 100% sure, Joe, where they're getting the details from, but it's making it harder for us. We've enough to be doing with the guidelines without having to do all this as well.
And do you think it is a deliberate policy to try and disrupt?
Oh, I do indeed.
Because you've opened indoor dining for people who have the vaccination.
The vaccine, yeah.
And what type of reaction did you get at the door yesterday? How were your staff getting on at the door?
No, yesterday wasn't too bad. It was grand. Now, anyway, that we dealt with was fine. But like on Saturday, there was a protest around the corner from us.
Yeah.
And a lot of people passing by the anti-vaccine did say a few things to people outside and things to me myself.
And what did they say to you?
Just about the vaccine. Oh, people drinking out in the sun and we're not allowed in, no vaccines, all this like stupid stuff like.
You know, so. Could it damage your business? What do you do when you've a no show? Can you get six other people in a hurry? No.
Well, the way it is at the moment, still people are still afraid to go inside. The older generation, I think, is still afraid to go inside.
Okay.
You know, so I don't know, to be honest.
But you could.
I'm fully vaccinated, Paula. And I think that this is a well orchestrated campaign to undermine the efforts that the restaurants and the pubs are making. I mean, they're bending over backwards to try to not discriminate against the unvaccinated. So I don't see why these people are pushing this and being so destructive and malicious. Yeah. You know, it really is not acceptable. It's very unsavory to throw that in there.
And John, when I make a booking in Doheny Nesbitt, so I know you have a gastro pub and a very good reputation for food as well as your other end of your emporium. But when I make a booking for indoor dining, do I have to give you a credit card?
No.
Well, that might. But then again, how can you prove the credit card is genuine?
Oh, I know. Yeah, no. When we're taking bookings, you just take a name and a phone number.
So you are over a barrel, really. Anyone could be ringing you.
Yeah, anybody can be ringing you.
Unless you ring them back immediately, that's the only thing.
Yeah, but as I said, like it's making it tougher for us. As I said, we're following all the guidelines, and this just makes it harder for all the staff.
And have you any idea how many fake bookings you've been hit with this week so far?
Well, yesterday, Helen was saying it was about 50 or 60 emails.
And they were fake?
Fake, yeah.
Wow, that's some hit.
Yeah.
So one pub, Doheny and Nesbitt's, got hit by 50 fake bookings.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's a despicable tactic under the circumstances and after, you know, the efforts and the hardships that everybody has been through at all different levels.
Oh, yeah, and it makes it harder for everybody. I mean, like, the restaurant was ringing you to see, is your booking confirmed? And you're in shock.
Yeah. I don't like being impersonated, and I would be keen to find out how exactly they did get hold of my details. And when I was chatting to Helen, she said that some of the people that she was trying to phone back, there might have been a mismatch on the spelling or the email address.
Yeah.
Or there mightn't have been an answer. But with me, they had everything present and correct.
John, you don't have a lot of space out front, sure you don't, unless you've, in other words, you don't have a lot of outdoor space.
What we have outside, we've 10 barrels out the front.
Okay.
That's all we have out the front.
But in other words, if your indoor business is disrupted this badly with 50 fake emails in one day, you can't continue.
No.
It would be very concerning if it's been happening with a lot of other businesses as well.
Okay, Linda, well, let's try and find out. 1850 715 815 joe@rt.ie. Linda, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
You have what you think is a solution. Go ahead, to John.
Well, I don't understand why, if people are accepting a reservation, they don't at the same time take credit card details and at that time deduct a certain amount per person.
Yeah.
That would soon put a stop to that.
Yeah, I would, big time, yeah. But a lot of people that book, you're trying to look after them as well, so you don't want to be taking deposits off them either. But, but the way it's going now at the moment, we're going to have to do something.
Well, I feel so sorry. There are so many people who own pubs and restaurants who have suffered greatly over the last year or so. And yes, I understand you do feel bad, or you would like to be nice to these people, but you know, it's survival of the fittest. You guys have to take care of yourself.
Yeah, it is indeed.
But I got the phone call yesterday, Joe, just after 12, and Helen had said to me that the email had come in on Friday evening. So, to my mind, there's a little centre of people on keyboards somewhere who have decided to hit a volume of businesses and make a volume of bookings, and they've had plenty of time to do that. And with the establishments working understaffed, possibly because of the requirements and the procedures that they have to meet, they obviously aren't going to get to check the emails or the bookings or phone them back until the day that they're due.
And I also take John's point that after being closed for a long, long time, every restaurant and cafe and pub is trying to bend over backwards to welcome people back. You don't want to be too intrusive.
It just makes it more, you know, I'm enraged by it to be...
I'm also enraged. I think it's the most despicable thing I've ever heard.
Well, they're stealing the identity of real people, whoever they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I assure you, Joe, there's only one of me.
Say again, Paula.
Assure you there is only one of me.
No. Okay, John O'Brien, keep going.
Okay, but the way it is now, Joe, is because of the guidelines, we have to have someone scanning people, and then we have to have someone out the front making sure people go in and out the right door. So that's two staff gone straight away.
Yeah, and how's that working? How does that work?
Well, as I said, yesterday was okay, but if you get 40 or 50 people coming at the one time, we'll see how it goes then.
Well, personally, I think if you were to ask, if I was in a situation like that, I would volunteer my family members. I would ask my family members to help. I think that I'm living in Limerick. The next time I go past one of my favourite restaurants, I will offer my services to go through those bookings for them.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wonder, John, now that somebody has to hand call out their details to you, I just wonder, will people start getting business cards again? Will they just hand you a business card, which you keep, you check it against their identity, and so you don't have to transcribe? There must be easier ways of doing it. I think business cards might make a comeback. You know, if I hand you my name and address and phone number, rather than having to take 5 minutes and how do you spell... or Murahurtig or whatever. Just hand you. I hope that small printers around the country are inundated with people trying to get buying cards with the details that they can hand. Brian is in Matfern. And Brian, good afternoon.
How you doing, Joe?
Yeah, you say when you check into a hotel, go ahead.
Yeah, people are asking about credit card details. And it suddenly struck me that when you're checking into a hotel, the receptionist would always ask for your credit card details, and it will pre-authorize a sum of money.
Exactly.
It isn't taken off your card. It isn't like a deposit that is already paid over.
It's a real card. Yeah.
Indeed.
John, how do you feel about going? Everyone is saying take credit card details and hit them with a €25 fine. But can you verify your credit card immediately?
No.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, I mean, like, you can take the details and put it through, but it's just, you know what, we've only two bars open at the moment out of seven bars.
I know.
Out of seven bars. So we've a limited space.
Yeah, yeah.
Inside there now at the moment. So, and the outside space there as well.
And I just wonder, because we've been, well, if we were to do it every day, I know every other program's been doing, but we did because we were inundated with other stuff. But like the number of calls we were getting every day about this COVID helpline, the vaccine cert helpline, I just wonder, was that deliberately clogged up by people?
Could be.
Might people, be another tactic, yeah.
People are going mad. Okay.
Unfortunately, trust has gone out of the window on this one.
Well, the other thing is, well, it's a small minority, but a small minority, once you get going on keyboards, can wreak havoc, as we discovered recently with the cyber attack. John Mount. John is owner of the Baker's Table in Lismore in beautiful Waterford. Go ahead, John.
How are you? How's things?
Are you getting hoax bookings?
Oh, we are. It's been a really tough time. We're getting, you know, and we're calling them back, and it's just uncontactable.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, we only opened up 6 weeks ago. So we're a brand new restaurant, you know, which you don't really see many of them opening up during COVID.
Fair play to you. There's optimism.
Yeah,
fair play
exactly.
To you.
Exactly. But it's, we're getting, like last weekend, we had a really tough weekend. Tables not turning up, no shows. And then now it's the hoax bookings that are really starting to, they're destroying the business, you know.
So can you think of any way around it?
I'm not quite sure. So I'm looking at a few different booking options now for deposits and things like that. But I just really don't want to do that. I feel like it's really not necessary for the local people because they've just supported me through the whole of COVID.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's no option, you know.
So how many have you, Donnie and Esmond got 50 fake emails yesterday that they subsequently discovered to be fake. So that could destroy a business.
Oh, completely. We've been open now, so we're coming into our seventh week of being open, and we're only open 3 days at the moment, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, for brunch and dinner. And, you know, over that time, I'd say we're probably about the same sort of amount of bookings, probably about 50 throughout the whole of that, not in one evening or anything like that, but there'll be, you know, there's six this day in the daytime, and then there'll be 10, 12 at the evening, you know, and it's really tough because we get so many calls wanting to book tables that are legitimate. And how do you know which is which?
Yeah, you know,
that's the thing. And I don't want to turn anybody away, but we're turning people away and we could really use that table, you know.
And I'm trying to think of angles. You know, the airlines overbook sometimes. They overbook a flight. They try and factor in no-shows. That wouldn't work for you.
You're going to laugh at me now. I tried that one on Friday and everybody turned up. And it put me in the opposite situation. Luckily, we were able to get past that. A few tables left a bit earlier and things like that. But we tried that and it put us in a close call situation. Thank God we were okay, you know.
But given, well, you're only open, which is fantastic, and congratulations, Sean, for opening the Baker's Table in Lismore. But I'm just thinking, restaurants that have been closed for nearly 16 months with a little gap in the middle, trying to keep them. Now, I know they got government support in the meantime, but it was hardly largesse. Back open, and then you've got this concerted campaign to destroy them almost because they're taking people as per the government guidelines, have been vaccinated. Paula.
If they are doing it, you know, with large volumes as they seem to be, is there a route whereby the guards could check the IPN, you know, go back to the source of the centre of where all of this is
coming
from?
I agree with you, but if John O'Brien and Donnie and Nesbitt got 50 fake email requests with so-called genuine names and numbers like your one was, how can the Garda who are up to their eyes, I presume, with the HSE cyber attack still, how do you even start? Where would you even start?
The Restaurants Association could club together and try and get it privately investigated or something.
Well, it's just a nasty, nasty campaign. It really is on a business that's been so vulnerable and so important to the rich tapestry of Irish life. Paula, good to meet you, Marco. John O'Brien, best of luck at Donnie and Esmond. John, given that Donnie and Esmond was the cabinet up to a few years ago, was a cabinet at play, they used to all head round and you're a regular haunt for journalists and politicians. Have any politicians been in?
No,
you haven't changed, John. I asked you that years ago, and you see,
who goes. No, you didn't. I wasn't there, Joe. I know you from somewhere else.
I know.
Kylie's in Donnybrook.
Kylie's there. But I also know there was always a tradition in Donny Nesbitt's. No matter who rang, they would never reveal who was in the bar or the lounge. Okay, John, well done. And Donny and Nesbitt's,
really
keep going.
And
Toners and the Bag It In, keep going as well. John Mount in the Baker's Table in Lismore. You're open. When are you open, John?
So we're open Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we do brunch from 11 until 3, and then we do the supper club menu. So we do nine small plates, and then we do a few main courses as well. So you can share amongst three or four dishes between you, or you can have starter, main course, desserts, you know.
Okay, you might as well run through the menu while you're at it, John. You're great, great, but fair play to you. I'm just this is naive as well. I say to people, well, if you're driving by a restaurant and you want to make a booking, stick your head in.
That's the best way.
Yeah, it's impractical as well for a lot of people.
I think it's hard for, you know, obviously every restaurant's different, but for ourselves, we're in the middle of everywhere, but the centre of nowhere, you know, we're in the evening time, there's no passing trade. In the daytime, there is, which is great for tourists. But in the evening, there isn't. So it kind of, we rely on bookings. We don't get really many walk-ins in the evening. So it's kind of like we rely on that, you know.
Just before you go, John, give me the name of your restaurant again. I didn't catch it.
It's the Baker's Table of Lismore.
Well done. Beautiful Lismore.
Thank you very much.
In the shadow of Lismore Castle and the home of the one of the greatest Irish writers ever, still alive and well, and that's the great Dervla.
She was in on Saturday.
Murphy, the most.
She was in on Saturday for dinner.
I hope you had a pint of Guinness for her, have you? Doesn't she like her pints? Yeah.
No, she brought a dog in, though.
Of course she does. Dog goes everywhere. Okay, John, you're privileged to have such a writer in your environs, Dervla Murphy. Brian in Rathfarm, Gurry Milamaga, Joe at RT Daddy.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
The great Brian McGuinness tells me the bag it in is already gone. I didn't know that. Well, I have to search how long I've been in the city centre. Cathal O'Keeney. Cathal, you're not in the city centre, but you went to that massive Circle K filling station, probably the biggest in Dublin, at Dublin Port.
That's correct.
And what happened? You're in your camper van, aren't you? Lucky to have a camper van.
Absolutely. And I was going to enjoy a weekend away after 2 years.
Good man.
And I parked up at the Circle K last night at 7:30 and went in for a litre of milk because I was going on the boat, on the Stena 820 boat.
Okay.
And I said I'd make myself a cup of coffee after checking in at the ferry.
Yeah.
And when I walked back towards the camper with my milk on tow, I zapped the central locking, hopped into the back of the camper, started to put the milk in the fridge, and the next thing I heard, the passenger left-hand front door open. This guy jumped in, took my bag, my wallet, the whole lot, and gone into a car, and three of them went headed off to over on the roundabout and gone.
So he was waiting for you to zap?
Oh, yeah. No, well, I have a feeling if I hadn't come out in time, they might have smashed the window. I don't know.
And was your man bag visible?
Oh, it was on the passenger seat, yes, stupidly enough. But.
Ah, well, that's you were running into your God. You've nothing. Yeah. And what was in the man bag?
My wallet was the primary thing, my cards. I drive a coach for a living for Carnies in Little Island in Cork. And my TACO card, my CPC card, my driving licence, all of that was gone, plus my credit cards, of course. There was a sat-nav and my sunglasses and a few bits and pieces. Lucky enough, there was no huge amount of cash.
But you didn't get the ferries, though.
No, I didn't. I went down to the ferry because I had to wait for the Gardaí to come. Now, they came quite quickly. They were quite good and they were very helpful and they told me exactly what to do by way of cancelling the debit and credit cards. And, you know, they were so helpful. They took photographs and whatever. Obviously, ran a make on the car because I got the reg number.
A good man.
But it wasn't much good to me because my nephew rang me about an hour ago to tell me that the car is for sale in Dundeal in a dealership in the Naas Road in Dublin. It's actually visible on Dundeal if you want to look at it.
So it's false number plate.
False number plate, yeah.
Ah, for God's sake.
Yeah. So many
of them in the car?
Three. But the guy behind the filling station counter came out, obviously, and he said, you're not going to believe this. He said, the CCTV camera just doesn't cover the spot where you are. And they were actually parked on the opposite side of that. So even if there was, my camper was shielding their car. Plus the fact that he said that I'm the fourth person in the last couple of weeks to be done.
Just bounced in like that.
I'm amazed the dealership or the garage or forecourt having some warning sign up, you know. And that's my main reason for ringing today. I think that, you know, the people should be made aware of this. I mean, four in a couple of weeks, you know, are we going to have five and six and seven before it stops?
And people are going to the ferry there.
They are, I mean, like... You know, I'm lucky. The only thing I lost really that was of any real value was my dad, God rest him, gave me a little card that I used to keep in my wallet when my boy became a man, a little verse, and I kind of read it every so often just to give me a little bit of encouragement to continue on in life, you know. But
your dad left you a poem with it, and he wrote a note on it.
My dad, when he was just coming into the early stage of dementia, he died in 2016.
Okay.
And he bought this little thing somewhere in some boot sale somewhere, and he signed it and he gave it to me.
A little poem,
and I had it in the front of the wallet all the time. But anyway,
did you check bins or anything around? This is what these couriers do.
The Gardaí said they'd do that. I mean, I wasn't going to hang around Dublin. Yeah. I just came back home to Care last night. I just didn't have
you
the
went,
heart
you
to
went,
go.
You went back home.
I came back home, yeah. I mean, there was no point in hanging around. I didn't know what I was doing at that point, you know.
And would you not have parked up there and slept in your van?
I could have done, but the mood wasn't in me. And then the other thing was I know that if you know, when I come back from England, I'll have to self quarantine. I need to get my taco card. I can't drive now at the moment. If I had a run tomorrow, I couldn't do it because I've got no taco card to put into the tachograph. Modern buses require this inserted card with a barcode on it. You know.
And where were you heading?
I was going to England.
And where were you going? Were you carefree and fancy?
Oh yeah, just the friends of ours over in Blackpool. I hadn't seen for 2 years. I was just going over there for a couple of days and coming back again on Friday. You know. And
that's the joys of the camper van.
Isn't it? Of the camper van, yeah.
Is it expensive to put a camper van on a ferry? By the way.
No, 250 odd each way.
Oh, great. Well, that's.
Yeah, I mean, it's only 50 or 80 quid more than a car, I believe, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry. But then your name is Cathal O'Keeney. It's an unusual name, if anyone finds
any... And a good Donegal name.
Good. If anyone finds any cards or any wallets with that name on it, hopefully. So when will you head?
Pardon?
Are you going to head?
I must say, first of all, the Gardaí were excellent, but... Far more important, I have to mention that the lady, I went down obviously to the ferry port, and I was late for the ferry, but she was still in the check-in desk. And she, first of all, I told her the story, and she said, look, the first thing she said, I'm so sorry, she said, are you all right for money? And I thought that was amazing, you know. So I want to give her a big...
This is the woman at the Stena desk.
At the Stena desk, yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
And he didn't make a song and dance saying you've lost your ticket.
Not at all. No, I rang today now and they said, look, you know, do you want to go? So I said, to be honest, I said, I don't feel like going back out of Dublin tonight. I said, can I change that to Rosslare? So your man was absolutely so helpful, no charge, absolutely fine.
Because I've been listening to the Stephen Nolan show over the last... It's on radio, BBC Radio Ulster, in the morning, and... Stena have been getting a terrible time.
No, they couldn't have been nicer.
Because they were accused of packing lorry drivers too into a cabin during the pandemic. But anyway, we haven't got, maybe we have, I don't think we've got any calls to that effect. But anyway, that's a shout out for Stena and their staff at Dublin Port. Mm-hmm. Well done. Okay, Cathal, and thanks for saying that. Mind yourself travelling, Cathal.
All right, okay. But as I say, just make sure that the filling station, I mean, they should have signs up.
Yeah.
You know, please, especially when it happened 4 times in the last couple of weeks.
And more CCTV also.
More CCTV, yeah.
They're available in Aldi and Lidl for $19.99 weeks in the Isle of Shame there down the middle.
Yeah.
Okay, Cathal, good to meet you, Mark.
Thank you for letting me on. God bless.
And thanks for contacting. Safe travels. 51551 Joe.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at RT.ie. And back to the report which we received yesterday from a listener. It's the Jesuit report, the internal report into Joseph Marmion, as they call him. He was Father Joseph Marmion, still is, according to their headstone at their grave erected by the Jesuits in Glasnevin. But listeners to the programme, that's a good 8-9 months ago, would have heard people complaining about Joseph Marmion. But the Jesuits admitted yesterday that they have that they did cover up the fact that he was an abuser for many years. Maurice Stokes is in Toronto in Canada. Maurice, you've now seen the report. What do you think of it?
first of all, listening to your show yesterday, and thank you for contacting me. When I listened to your show yesterday, I agree with the comment that this is a template for past actions of abuse within Catholic institutions, Catholic schools, whether it's in Canada, the States, or Ireland, wherever. But it's not independent, so I don't have any confidence. I'm not questioning the integrity of the people who are writing the report, but the reality is that this is not an independent report. I have always advocated for that it's imperative, as I said to myself the other day, that it be an independent report by an arm's-length body. And this is like having the fox in the hen house, you know.
It's a report by the Jesuits about the Jesuits for the Jesuits.
Yeah, well,
in that sense.
When I worked in England years ago, I learned an old trade union phrase: "He whose bread I eat, his song I sing." To put it in the proper vernacular, you know, the pipe, isn't it? The piper calls the tune, yeah, sort of thing.
But when you contacted us originally, you made the point that your parents didn't believe you.
No, they didn't. My mother in particular, she adored the grounds that the Jesuits walked on.
Yeah, as a lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah, my mother was of a Roman Catholic background, a Dubliner, and my father was a Dubliner, but of a Protestant Unionist background. And his attitude was, well, I pay the Jesuit, I write the Jesuits a check, they do their thing. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
In other words, he trusted them, but he wasn't crazy about them.
And you say, Marmion, I remember this from your original call, Marmion made my life hell. He didn't sexually abuse me, but he used a pandy bat on him. And he used to...
He didn't use the pandy bat on me.
Okay.
He did on other boys, but the point was I made was I had Marmion, I think, in my last 2 years in Crescent. And
Limerick.
Yeah, and he made my life hell. And... I avoided him on one to one, like I'd be going down the stairs to get my, you know, to get my coat and a cloak, and there was no one else around, and he'd sort of block my way, and the same in the bicycle shed. I didn't even know the facts of life then, believe it or not. But the whole point was, the guy made me feel very distressed and uneasy. My father physically hadn't been well. He had nearly died. He was in Barrington's hospital with an internal physical complaint, and he'd been recovering at home. I didn't want to bother my father. My mother had a nervous breakdown at the same time. The Jesuits knew about all that. But the thing was that Marmion, I felt at the time, and that was my feeling, was a bully. But I was very isolated. I didn't sort of have anyone to talk to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
And the eldest of six kids, you know? And Marmion was sarcastic, bombastic, and he like had free rein. He could do what he liked.
And
I could see from my observations that some of the fellow Jesuits, they sort of gave him a wide berth, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't know whether you got a chance to read the whole, well, it's 52 pages, to read the whole
52
report.
52 pages, like, I'm bright, but not that bright, you know?
Yeah, and is my memory correct? At one stage he told you, Marmion told you, that you'd make a good airline hostess.
Oh, yes, he made a reference to Aer Lingus were coming to the school to talk about careers. And then he made a reference to me in front of the other boys. Oh, and Stokes, you should go to that meeting and find out. You'd make a very good airline hostess, you know?
And did he say this in front of other boys?
Yes, he did. But you know what amazes me? What amazes me is that it doesn't amaze me. I understand it. I was reading last night about the wall of silence, and I've even had people in Canada say to me, "You better be very careful about what you're saying about the Jesuits. They got very deep pockets. They could go after you. You know."
Mm.
Now, these are from good people who are concerned for my well-being. You know what I mean?
Wow.
But people have that fear out there. And, you know, the reality is we're dealing with situations here. And I can understand why some people don't call in because of fear. And the thing is that... The legal situation today, I'm not a lawyer, but the whole thing has become so complex.
Yeah.
It shuts people's mouths because they're afraid to say anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But to read the report, and it's as I say, 52 pages, but it's to read the Jesuits' admission of what Marmion was doing and admitting that as far back as 1948. They had doubts about him recorded. Now, a lot of the paperwork either subsequently, especially when...
Well, they had doubts about making him a permanent member of the Jesuit order.
That's
and
right.
I was reading that about his brutish behaviour and his irresponsibility and...
His inappropriate behaviour with other students. We don't know what that was about.
Yeah, and in those days they had lots of candidates they could pick and choose, but for some reason they kept him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I can recall I was back in Ireland back in the 70s, I think it was, on holidays, and I met some guys I knew, and they had gone to Clongowes, and we just got talking over a pint. I just met them by pure chance and never met them since. And they hadn't seen me for years. Anyway, in when Marmion was in Clongowes, I think he might have been prefect of studies, but
he was.
But this student and another student, they said that they rebelled against him, and that their parents contacted senior people in the Jesuit order, and that's what got Marmion out of that got Marmion out of Clongowes. And how that came out was, I said, "Oh, I was in Bray, and I was walking along the boardwalk, and I saw Marmion, hadn't seen him since I left school, and he didn't see me." But I said, the sight of that man made me, you know, it made me angry, but I decided to contain my anger, and I just avoided him and gave him a wide berth, and he was sitting on a bench looking out at the sea. And he was just a rough, brutish character. But what I told you last month was,
like,
on the radio,
in fairness to the Jesuits, sorry, Mars, we're going to cry. They admit that he was rough, brutish, and difficult.
Absolutely. But I'm looking at on my screen.
But they also say categorically he was a paedophile.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
They
and
do
I
categorically
didn't
know that
say until,
that.
Until,
and that he sexually abused
this year.
He sexually abused boys in their care. I want to go to another section of the report. This is, I'm reading directly from the report.
Yeah,
Father Barber,
ahead.
Who's Father Noel Barber, who we're in contact with, and we hope to be able to have him on the programme. Father Noel Barber was head of the Belvedere when the first, they say, credible sexual allegation, which Barber said he believed, was made against Marmion in 1977. Remember, he wasn't reported to the Gardaí. He was moved again, eventually.
But that should have been reported to the Gardaí, and not alone is that irresponsible, it's in violation of I'm sure, the Education Act in the Republic of Ireland, because the Jesuits were in loco parentis.
It's a violation of the law. But anyway, Father Barber, heard on the radio in 2021, this is Liveline, we now know he's talking about, a former pupil speaking about his suspension from Belvedere in either 1973 or 74, in other words, long before 77, following an argument between the former pupil and Joseph Marmion. Father Barber recalls this episode, that the former pupil refused to accede to an unreasonable demand made by Joseph Marmion with regard to the matter. Father Barber considered the former pupil's account on radio to be fair and accurate. Now, that pupil who contacted us a number of months ago was Shane Slattery, and Father Barber is listening again. It's 1850 715 815, if he wants to apologise to people like Shane Slattery.
Yeah.
Shane is on the line. Shane, what was your, remind people of your encounter with Marmion in 73 74?
Joe, it was just one night. There was a debate there between Belvedere and a girls' school, and in Belvedere College. And after the debate, we all retired down to a common room. It was down in the basement of Belvedere College.
Okay.
And I was late coming down, and just in hijinks, I jumped over a table, and I hadn't seen Marmion there.
Okay.
And, well, he came over to me, and in front of, I mean, there must have been 60 people there, about, including the girls from the girls' school, and he proceeded to completely humiliate me, and, you know, you're no good at this, you're no good at sports, you're academically, you're useless, you have no friends, nobody likes you, you're a complete failure. And that went on for about 5 minutes, Joe.
In front of everybody?
In front of everyone. And I was completely taken aback. I didn't know what to say. And I just, he left the room then. And
okay.
I said to a friend of mine, and Joe Curtin, I remember, and I just said, Joe, I'm not letting him away with that, will you?
Now, you're 16, 15, 16.
I'd say it was about 16 or 17, Joe.
Okay.
I can't.
Okay.
It was either 50 or 60.
So you
remember.
Say, now, the other interesting thing I find, was there young women involved in the opera?
No.
Okay, because that is bizarre.
Well, maybe there was. Not. I did it a couple of years, Joe, and
where boys used to play the part of girls.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And boys used to dress up as girls, obviously.
Yes.
And Marmion used to bring them in and kit them out.
Yeah. Now,
okay. I know you've no hand actor part in that, but but Shane, okay, you said to your mate Joe, I'm not letting this go.
Yeah, and so I went up looking for him, and he was in a room off the main yard of the school, and you could there was windows on the outside, you could look in, and he was in there. It was actually a science lab, and there was a piano in it there, and he used to have opera practice there. And he was in there playing the piano, and I said, Joe, just keep an eye through the window, and I went into him.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting at the piano, and he saw me coming in, and he looked up, and he smiled, and I said, this so-and-so thinks I'm coming in to apologise to him.
Right.
And so I walked up to him, stood in front of him, and I just said, don't you ever effing talk to me like that again, ever in your life.
And you uttered the word effing like it was...
I did. Joe.
I also stood up to him as well.
Okay, well, Finn, I'll come back to you in a sec, Morris. Shane, tell us his reaction when you said, don't you ever.
He jumped up out of his seat. Now, he was a big man. I'm about 5'11".
Yeah, he's a very big man.
He's, I'd say, 6'2", 6'3". And he jumped up, and I thought he was going to take a swing at me, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and he just walked out, and then I rejoined my friends down in the common room. Must say, I was a little bit shaky after it.
I can imagine, yeah. Okay, so what happened?
And then the next morning, I was in class, and Barbara came in. He just said, Shane Slattery, get your bag and go home.
Why? Why?
I would say that Marmion had made a complaint to him.
No, did you say to Noel Barber, why?
No, he didn't even ask me. He didn't give me an opportunity to...
So you couldn't put...
Joe, I didn't actually say to him why, because I knew what it was about.
Yeah, but he didn't give you... He didn't... Did Noel Barber know that Marmion had you humiliated you in front of your peers? 50 or 60 boys and girls?
No, he didn't. Because he was only hearing what Marmion...
So, but surely Noel Barber would have said to Marmion... Unless he was even more powerful. I know he was powerful, and he was a disruptive character, apparently, wherever he went, even in the fraternity. But did Noel Barber even say to Marmion, why did Shane Slattery, I don't know whether you had a reputation in the school, had you as a troublemaker, I don't know what way you were, but...
I wouldn't have been the best.
I'm saying you didn't have... You hadn't been previously suspended.
Yeah, I had once before. Yeah.
But my point is that Noel Barber, either he didn't say to Marmion, well, Marmion said he came in and told me to go F myself or whatever, and Barber didn't say, well, why?
No, because I'd say that was the power... You know, Marmion was powerful. And obviously he gave Noel Barber a cock and bull story. But my mother, anyway, was in negotiations over the next 4 or 5 days with Noel Barber.
Okay.
After about 4 or 5 days, anyway, she said, look, you can go back into... Noel Barber is taking you back in.
Mm.
And so I went back in. He said, and I went to see him in his office when I arrived at the school that morning. And he said, look, you're back in. But he said, I'd like you to apologise to Marmion.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if that's a precondition of me coming back, Father, it's not going to happen.
Fair play to you.
You know, and he said, no, it's not a precondition, but I'd like you to do it. Well, I said, I'm not going to do it, Father. And he said, no, well, that's it, go back to your class. And I actually met Marmion walking down the corridor later on that morning, and I was delighted just to be able to give him a sort of a victorious smile. And I say it nearly killed him, Joe.
Now remember, Father Barber, it says in this report, now he also told us he had no hand actor part in the substance of this report, though he was interviewed for this about this and other episodes, including the fact that they now admit that they knew about Barber. Three of the senior Jesuits knew about Barber, but they only told each other. They decided not to tell the Gardaí. They decided to protect the institution. But Noel Barber does say, to his credit, Father Barber considered the former pupil's account on radio, this is you, Shane Slattery, to be fair and accurate.
Yeah, look, in fairness, Joe, I haven't read the full report. I've just seen the Irish Times report, but look, they, you know,
but should you,
I know what
should
Morris
you,
is saying
you,
there, that you can't.
But should you have not got the full report?
I probably should have, but I don't think they have my details because I didn't get in touch with them, Joe.
Okay, well, they could have. Well, we can't do the GDPR, but we, if they had got in touch with us, they could have asked us and we would have done it over the summer. Could you email all the people who contacted you saying these are the email details if you wish to contact them? But they didn't, but that's not, not a here to say. Catherine is on the line. Catherine, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
When did you when did you come across Father Joseph Marmion?
Well, it was the late 1990s, about two or three years before Father Marmion, or better not say Father Joseph Marmion, died. And I went up to see somebody in the hospital, in the private hospital, and she subsequently died, a great friend of mine. And but she had a lovely oratory downstairs, so I went down anyway, and there was mass on, and there was this priest. And he was so kind of, he was telling us, he was just a very interesting guy to listen to, you know. And I found out that he said mass. But I went up, started to go there on a Sunday, you know, and then I would go the odd occasional day then during the week. But I got to kind of know him, you know, the person that I'm hearing about here now at the moment, the other people are speaking about, it's like you're talking about two different people, you know. That's my observance. I never...
And
because,
so if I can come in there, like one of your speakers yesterday said he was a complete psychopath. And psychopaths can be completely charming. And that's what he was. He could be charming to the people that he needed to be charming to. But, I mean, the legacy of abuse and horror that he perpetuated on those young kids was absolutely appalling. And Joe, if I could just come in and say, I know your researchers have said to me they believe that many pupils haven't come forward that have been sexually abused by him. And I would urge all those pupils, just come and tell your story and you will be believed.
Yeah,
and even the telling of the story can be cathartic. And I'm actually not speaking in a vacuum here, Joe. I've experienced that kind of abuse myself, and not by Marmion, but I know what it's like. And, you know, what happened to me, Joe, I was getting the 16 bus home from school one day, and little did I know I was walking into 45 minutes of hell.
Right.
And this man just came and sat beside me and was at me for 45 minutes till I got off the bus. So I can't blame Marmion on that. But I know the shame and I know the devastation that that can cause, Joe. Yeah. And I would urge, even if you come and tell one person about it, it can be really, really healing and therapeutic. And I would urge any men that are listening to this that have been abused by Marmion, come and tell your story at least, and at least get it off your and somebody will listen to you. That's all I have to say about that, Joe.
Yeah, and you know, it's there's so many unanswered questions, or questions raised by this this report by the Jesuits, which we received. For example, some of it is quite Jesuitical in its writing. Maybe you can help me here, Shane and Morris. You went to a Jesuit school. On the 11th of November 2004, Father Humphreys again spoke with Father Barber, who confirmed what he told him previously. Father Barber knew nothing about the physical abuse mentioned in the book as having happened in Clongowes. This was to the journalist written by Tom Dooley. He suggested that Father Humphreys contact Father Paul Andrews, who was Province Prefect of Studies at the time. He confirmed, now I think that he is referring to Noel Barber, he confirmed that Marmion's bullying and paedophile tendencies were common gossip among the boys in the late 70s. It was all taken as common knowledge and that only the staff and the Jesuits didn't seem to know about it.
Joe, when I left in 74...
At this stage, I really think at this stage... The head of the Jesuits in Ireland, Leonard Maloney,
yeah,
who's as we heard, has come out very well in terms of trying to deal. But I think the implication for the Jesuit order, I don't think they fully appreciate the implications that are emerging from this report. But I really feel they refused to comment. The only thing they did to the Irish Times is confirm that what I read out yesterday was true. Big deal. Of course, it's true. I'm reading it directly from your report. I have it here in my hand. But they really need to come out and give a detailed explanation.
Would you ask Leonard Maloney to come on your show?
Yes, we have numerous times through their spokesperson, Patricia Coyle, but we're told they've no comment to make. They've no comment to make when these allegations were raised months ago, and they've no comment to make when this report, which they commissioned sent to some survivors. I'm not saying where we got it, but they've no comment to make on that either, because what do they say? It's ongoing. What's going? Ongoing. What's going on? Everything is ongoing. But they really need to put themselves forward. They receive, as we heard yesterday. Who was it? Some former pupil I was reading who was on before. He made the point that the Jesuits are extraordinarily good at networking, as you know, networking through their past pupils who do well in life, thankfully for various reasons, the Tony O'Reillys and the journalists that they know and the business people that they know. And these business people write to other business people who are in the school saying, would you like to donate to A, B, C or D? So they have an enormous trust. The brand has an enormous trust. I know you should use word brand when it comes to a religious order. And this is from their own point of view, this is undermined. And as I said previously, when I was reading again the Ryan report about industrial, because I don't know how the Rosminian order, for example, survived the Ryan report. I don't know how they didn't fold up their tent in shame and walk off the stage or amalgamate with another religious order, but they did. They should have, of course they should have. And the Jesuits would want to be extraordinarily careful about how they handle this. And that, in terms of the reaction I'm getting, and we're getting on the line, is that reaction articulated by Morris, by the Jesuits, for the Jesuits, about the Jesuits. Yeah. And there needs to be, given that they do profess to have other, and Father Peter McFerry is a Jesuit, there's other Jesuits that they do profess this interest. Well, they have an interest in social justice, no two ways about it. Okay, Catherine, did you know that when Father Joseph Marmion was chaplain to this private hospital, which included children as his patients, that he had been moved from Belvedere because of these allegations in 77 of sexual abuse, which Noel Barber says they believe is credible. They believed him, and they didn't report him. Three of them believed him, that he had been moved, well, eventually moved from Belvedere. He was given a year in Paris as a kind of holiday or whatever, and then he was taken back into the Jesuit home fraternity in Gardiner Street, and then from there he was given the job by the Jesuits as the chaplain in a private hospital, even though they knew that he was a paedophile.
It beggars belief, this what I'm hearing, to think that he was appointed by the Jesuits. The Jesuits, as I understand it, look after the chaplaincy, or did look after the chaptaincy in the private hospital. I knew that.
Yeah.
And there were other Jesuits used to stand in when he'd go off for 6 weeks to Austria, even in the late 1990s.
Morris, don't give me any details or indeed shame, but I hope the survivors, so to speak, I hope you have some way of keeping in touch with each other and supporting each other.
Well, what I can't help but notice is that listening to your shows and that certain people are talking out, but an awful lot of people are being silent, and some networks Shane said, I don't know Shane, but he's right. They have very deep connections. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, there's also a thing in it too that some people I feel will not talk because they don't want to damage their name or their family or whatever.
Yeah.
It is a whole sort of psychological, sociological sort of thing at play here, you know what I mean? Irish society, you know?
Well, I can tell you the two independent restorative facilitators, as they're described in the introduction to this report, Barbara Walsh and Catherine O'Connell, They've contacted us and they say they've given us email details if anyone wishes them. But they are the people. My understanding is they didn't write the report. They simply...
No, they didn't write the report.
They phoned people.
As far as I'm concerned, and this is my personal opinion, like, I haven't even heard from any of my siblings in Ireland. And they know about this, but the shut mouth, you know, the cone of silence is so obvious to me that it's the old story goes. I think people are afraid. And I know from experience that, you know, in the law favors those with deep pockets. People are afraid they might get sued or whatever, you know?
The thing is that
even though some of the people mentioned in these discussions are now dead, I understand that, you know, that, in other words, we're not educated in how free are we to speak today, you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay. Well, you've spoken very honestly on this, your second occasion now, Morris, and appreciate
Morris.
Yeah,
just one last thing was that I stood up to Marmion and I withdrew from his class and I was never punished by him or by anybody in the college. Okay. I attended all the other classes, but for the last couple of months in secondary school at the Crescent, I avoided his class. And I told him I didn't want anything to do with him.
And the last time I saw him, when
he was in Bray, I just said to myself, I don't want to speak to that guy, but I just looked at him. And he was like just, he reminded me of King Kong. You remember in the movie the way King Kong walked?
Yeah.
He was a big man and a bully. But it was obvious to me as a young lad at the Crescent that he had free rein to do what he wanted. And he was a brutish bully. And just one last thing. I was reading in the report there. It says that, and this was from a fellow Jesuit, Father Morrissey had felt at the outset that it was unlikely to prove a successful appointment given his personality. Joseph Marmion had a caustic wit, and so it must have been very hard for anyone who was at the receiving end of it. Touché.
And Morris, why did you stand up to him? What was that occasion?
Because the reason I stood up to him was because I knew that my father was recovering from a very serious physical illness and was on sick leave, and my mother had had a nervous breakdown, and I was on my own, and I was the eldest of six kids, and we weren't native to Limerick, and I felt the only way I can handle this bastard is... And that's all he was. It was just a brutish bastard. The only way I could handle him was not to engage and to avoid him entirely.
Okay.
And he never went after me, and the authorities in the school never went after me. And I found that very interesting, and that's why I contacted your show.
But did you have words with Marmion, my lad, Shane Slattery? You can go
with. No, what I said to him was, I've had enough of this. I don't want anything to do with you.
Okay.
And I would avoid him, and then he would see me, and he would follow me sometimes when nobody was around, and he blocked my way in the stairs, and I wouldn't talk to him, I wouldn't make eye contact, you know, and I can relate to what Shane was saying. I remember once coming up the stairs from the basement where the cloakroom was, and he saw me on the stairs, and he was a big man, and he blocked my way, and it was a sort of a standoff between the two of us, and I just took off, you know.
Okay.
I walked another way out
the
door.
He was a very sinister man, Joe.
Okay.
Very, very sinister.
Okay, what a picture.
And Shane describes him well. But the point was that we lived in fear of Marmion. And when he would make boys roll up their pants and give them and put their leg up on a seat of a desk, and then he'd come down and he'd give you the 1-2 with the weight of his hands. And he would give you more than one. And your leg would pain for days sometimes, you know?
Okay, Morris Stokes, thanks indeed. I know you're in Toronto and Canada, and Shane Slattery and Catherine as well. Joe?
And I thank Shane for having the courage to speak up. And by the way, I am aware that we are private individuals with limited resources. The Jesuits have very deep financial connections, know who some of them are. And they're not talking about this, or they're advising keep the wall of silence.
What I think is fascinating is shouldn't be throwing my own tubs into water, but just to finish, I think the Jesuits have always given the image that they are open, available, interested in social justice, interested in fairness in society, yeah, be it homeless or whatever, and yet not one of them, and we've spoken to a good few of them, including those in the public eye, and not one of them is prepared to step forward and, yeah, and speak publicly about what's happening. Okay, Maurice, go.
A complete wall of silence.
Well, then, John, I think Dennis Maloney should.
Behind legalese and all this.
Yeah.
And this report that I'm reading, I don't believe that that's independent. We need an arm's length report by somebody who has no connection whatsoever with the Jesuits.
Okay. Good evening, my Maurice Stokes, Shane Slattery, and Catherine Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
This is a very hard item to explain, because people generally in Ireland don't have an interest in the proliferation of street furniture, which is destroying our cities. Multiple signs, multiple bus stops, multiple bus companies. And you mainly hear complaints about it when visually impaired people have to navigate and chicane their way around because of all these many useless metal poles that are around the place. But Cyril McIntyre has great credit and great credibility and kudos in the topic he wants to talk about, because Cyril for many years was the voice of CIE in Ireland. Cyril, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay, and Cyril, will you explain why, as we now know, Dublin Bus, that great brand, CIE, that great brand, Irish Rail, that great brand, they're now all gone, and they're now subsumed into a quango. It's the same taxpayers' money, probably more actually, to run the quango. They're called TFI.
That's correct, Joe.
Which is a mimic, which is the same. TFI, is there's a thing called TFL in London called Transport
right.
for London. So what they do in Ireland is we take what they do in England, we put a doudine in his mouth and we put a little Aran sweater on them, and we call it Transport for Ireland. Will you explain how they've taken over the world? Every vehicle in Ireland that's used for transport, be it a taxi, be it a bus, be it a train, be it a long-distance bus, be it your number 47, they all now have this big logo on a TFI, and now we discovered every single bus stop is being removed in Dublin to put up a big yellow, garish, I think, TFI logo and the number of the bus. What has happened, Cyril?
Well, it goes back to the establishment of this National Transport Authority by the government in 2009, with the objective of administering the contracts for public service obligation bus services,
okay,
such as those run by Dublin Bus and Bus Éireann, and the funding for those services, socially desirable public transport services, is now channeled through the National Transport Authority, who have in turn, as you correctly said, copied TFL by calling it TFI, and they produced a blue and white colour scheme which appeared on the buses which were operated by Go Ahead on the outer suburban routes in Dublin, which were handed over from Dublin Bus, and which also appeared on the buses on the Kildare and Eden Derry routes which were handed over from Bus Éireann. And in the same exercise, these blue bus stops appeared, which were very similar to some signs in London. But it's a pity that they don't recognise that, you know, in London, while they made changes in the sense of having the same logo and colour on all the buses, no matter who owned them, London stuck with the traditional red colour scheme
and the traditional
bar and circle logo, which has been there for over 100 years. So
was Dublin Bus... It's gone from the bus stops. Is it gone from the buses? I couldn't find it any time, and I have a habit of noticing these things. I think the new... By the way, what do you think of these new snot green buses?
These green and yellow, I think it's a hideous colour scheme. As I said in my letter to the Irish Times some months ago, it's a hideous colour scheme, and it is replacing, this is the second colour scheme, it is now replacing the blue colour scheme which they started out with. And it has also appearing, it will appear on Bus Éireann vehicles throughout the country as well. Effectively, what is happening is that the identity of the individual bus companies is being subsumed by this Transport for
and
Ireland.
Why, well, Cyril, why is that important?
Well, you know, it is obviously quite okay to have a sort of a universal and integrated brand and logo for public transport in the country. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's an element, there should be an element of respect for tradition as well. And it seems to be forgot that from 1945, for many years, we did have a National Transport Authority. It was called Corps Sum Per Éireann. And, you know, it managed to do quite a lot of things quite well. It had an internationally recognised winged wheel symbol, which mm-hmm. was derived a little bit from the London Transport logo, but was designed by an Irish designer, Frank Brandt, back in 1941. And was discarded in the 1960s in favour of something that was designed by Scandinavian designers. And we now have a further iteration of new logos and new liveries, which at the end of the day won't make any difference to the quality of the service. It's simply a question of appearances.
And by, I know the buses are extraordinarily, but the buses in themselves are works of art, I think. The modern bus, just in terms of design and aerodynamic, they're extraordinarily expensive as well. Extraordinary, between a quarter and a half a million each.
That is correct.
So if the TFI, have they, given that they're painting and repainting the buses all the time and they want everyone to carry their sticker, their logo, have they more money than sense in a country that's bankrupt?
I think that's probably a question that it wouldn't be appropriate for me as a former CI and employee to comment on. But you know, as I said to your researcher earlier on, graphic designers and logo designers and brand managers don't come cheaply.
They sure don't. They sure don't. Where do all bus stops go to die?
Well, I suspect that they will end up in scrapyards. I hope that they keep a few of them for the Transport Museum out in Howth, so that we can go out there and remember some parts of Dublin in the rare old times as it used to be, you know?
Yeah, and the three hydrogen buses that they unveiled to great fanfare last month in Dublin, they cost €800,000 each.
My goodness, yes.
€800,000. Yes. John Keller, and at the wonderful National Transport Museum in Howth. John, you want to know where the bus stops have gone to die?
Hello, Joe.
Yes. What do you want quickly?
Well, they probably end up in the skip, the vast majority, but hopefully we will get some for display and for future use, because we get things like film companies coming looking for old bus signs when they're doing films. So,
but you know what we had, John, when I mentioned this in the promo earlier on, we had nursing homes contact us saying we have rooms in our nursing home for people with dementia, where they can sit listening to old-style radios and old-style, and we'd love some of the old bus stops just to put in the corridor, just that logo, which has been around for decades and was so identifiable and unique in Dublin. Anyway, we'll try and find out. We've asked Transport for Ireland. We've asked Dublin Bus, where are the old bus stops, and can nursing homes have the actual... They don't want the full bus stop, but they want the actual beautiful logo that was at top of it. Okay, John Keller, National Transport. Are you open, John, at the minute?
We are. We're open Saturday, Sundays and bank holidays.
And you're still totally volunteers, voluntary. One of the greatest museums in the country, run by volunteers in the grounds of Howth Castle in Dublin. Cyril McIntyre, former spokesperson for CAE, thanks for campaigning. Don't let our heritage die. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
It's Shane O'Gorman and Ray Darcy next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.